Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's occasional lecture. Don Aitken AO is really one of those people who does need no introduction, particularly to a Canberra audience. We've known of his work as Vice-Chancellor of the University of Canberra for many years, but today he appears more in connection with his position as Chair of the National Capital Authority. And he's going to give us a very interesting lecture about the development of Canberra as a planned city in the context of the development of other planned cities. Now, a little bit of housekeeping, because today as a special treat we have an illustrated lecture, and if any of you after the lecture would like to get a copy of Don's presentation, you can leave an email address with us at the back of the venue, and we will forward that on to you. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Don Aitken. Thank you.
Thank you, Rosemary, and ladies and gentlemen. In the next 30 minutes, I'd like to give you a sense of the importance of our national capital as a planned city, and by setting it in the context of other planned cities. We're used to hearing that our national capital is special, and it is, but it's only one of the more recent and is the most sustained of the attempts to build a new town. And if you go to Google, Professor Google is one of my great helps, and put in new towns, you'll get more than you ever dreamt of. History is simply full of them, and some of the oldest towns of which we have records started, like Canberra, in an empty or almost empty space and with a plan. So let me offer you the first one of them. This is Mohenjo-Daro in the Indus Plain, a site that has been claimed as the oldest planned city in the world. It's not at all the oldest city in the world, because that's probably Jericho, which is 11,000 years old. This one's only 5,000 years old. And it's worth remembering that, it's as a historian, this I feel this again and again, that all of human history in social terms is only 11,000 years old. In the time since Jericho was started and we began to grow crops and herd animals and stay in the one place, everything that you see around you has developed. It's about 400 generations, if you like to think of 400 of sons, fathers, grandfathers, and so on. That's one reason I'm an optimist. We were just talking about that. I'm an optimist. Human beings have done this in 11,000 years. They will do better in the future. But back to Mohenjo-Daro. It's a very sophisticated place. It's got a sewage system, and here is the excavation of that. And it has a rectangular grid layout. There you go. That's what it looked like. Only a tiny bit of Mohenjo-Daro has been excavated, because once you excavate it, it starts eroding straight away because of wind and rain and so forth. It had separate dwellings which were protected for privacy and against noise, public buildings, a central marketplace, a lot of infrastructure to ensure good water supply from the Indus alongside of its earlier bank it stood, and high levels of sanitation. Every house seemed to have a place where you poured water on yourself. It even had what is called the Great Bath, which I don't think was a municipal swimming pool, but it was probably a place for religious observance. We can guess from all of this that Mohenjo-Daro, which housed about 35,000 people, had a system of government. But all that remains of it is ruins, and most of them are still under the sand, as I said. What happened to it? We don't really know. It lasted about 1,000 years, and then people stopped living there. It may have been flooded. It probably was flooded several times, although it was built on a high bank. It may have been invaded. There may have been a plague. We simply don't know. And that's true of a very large number of old cities that have disappeared. For reasons lost to us, a society decides to build a new town. It starts with a plan. The plan is likely to include defence, water, sanitation, easy communication within the walls, a marketplace, a public granary, public buildings, temples, and the rest. And people live there, and it works. And then something happens, a flood or an earthquake or an invasion or a fire or a plague. But the outcome is that the city loses its purpose, and a lot, or all of its people. Those remaining can't maintain it. Best example of that is Rome. The Romans were the first great urban planners, and ancient Rome reveals a good deal of very clever and thoughtful urban planning. But the urban planning skills of Rome were lost with the fall of the Roman Empire. Now, not all cities have begun like Mohenjo-Daro. Some at river crossings like Oxford, or close to river junctions like Babylon, or at obvious intersections and trading routes like Istanbul, or at good ports like New York. They just begin because people take advantage of the site, and then more people come and it simply grows. And sooner or later someone says, hey, we better do a bit of planning here, and that planning takes place, and then the city grows more and the planning is overcome by circumstance. But most of the cities of which we have extensive knowledge over a long period of time, you can see that almost like layers, planning periods and ad hoc periods and then more planning periods and so on. The lack of planning has very expensive consequences over time, for it requires what we now call retrofitting, going back and doing what should have been done much earlier. A city that I know reasonably well is Bangkok, and it's a good example. Its freeways and rapid transit railway systems have had to overcome the fact that the city is built on a soggy plain and you can't cheaply put an underground system into it. And the cars came first, so the municipal bus system is very much secondary. A very large number of people live in Bangkok, and it's still as difficult to get around as it was when I first went there in 1971, 40 years ago. Over the last 10,000 years, there seem to have been two separate and conflicting building sentiments throughout the history of towns and cities. One is the desire to start again, for whatever reason, an earthquake or a tidal wave or a new city like this one, marking a new beginning of some kind. The other can be likened to the effect of a magnet. Established settlements attract people who tend to come whether or not there's any planning for them at all. We tend to think in Canberra that, of course, you do the infrastructure first. You know, you go out to Wright and Coombs and you put in the roads and you put in the sewage, you put in the water supply, you put in the curbs and gutters, and then the people come. That's absolutely unusual. It's usually the other way around. People build shanties and later somebody comes along and says, we better make this a proper road, so they make it straight and so forth. Many settlements have been planned from the beginning, but no settlement followed the plan. And another one is you can have plans and nobody comes at all. Those of you who like going to the coast will have seen a sign saying Currawong, and if you look on the maps, you'll find a very elegant set of city streets, town streets for a town called Currawong, which just doesn't exist. Now, it was a good idea at the time. The New South Wales surveyors came and they planned it, but nobody else came. Most country towns in New South Wales were planned by the Surveyor General or his staff, and you can see their work in the current grids of those streets. I grew up in One Armidale. It was planned, and I've forgotten now, 1830-something, and the plan is still there in the middle. But cities are different. Their growth can proceed so quickly that the original plan becomes inadequate and planners are unable to cope. Sydney grew in a rather random way until the arrival of Governor Macquarie, who reorganised the streets of the port and he named them, mostly members of the Hanoverian royal family. Well, those ones that you know, they're apart from Pitt, but George and Kent and all the rest of it, they're brothers of the king. But in 1830, the city of Sydney, as we know it today, had been defined, and here it is. That's the bottom part is the city of Sydney. But look at what is now Pyrmont. And you can see that there were once two estates. One is still there. It's Dr. Harris's estate. And it's been kept. A road has been put right through, and at the tip of Pyrmont, the developers have moved in. They're starting to flog off little blocks of land. They're still there, and they're worth a great deal of money. And once you've done that, it's done. It's very hard to undo. I'll give you an example of where people do undo it later on. It was not until 1948 that there was any sort of plan to cover the whole of the city of Sydney, and many of you here will remember, it was called the Greenbelt, and it surrounded the city, and there was to be no building in it. It lasted 11 years. Greenbelt went. The county of Cumberland, gone. Everything, why? City was growing at 4 to 5% a year. Plans can't cope with that unless they're extraordinary. A better example, move to Adelaide, but I'll do that in just a moment. The Greenbelt was to be rather like the Adelaide Parklands, but on a huge scale. But the rapid growth of the city after the war meant that the Greenbelt had gone, and nothing much has changed in Sydney. Continued rapid growth and the topographical difficulty of Sydney with the flooded Parramatta River means that Sydney is simply a continuing planning nightmare. And it's not. There are good reasons why the New South Wales government spends such a colossal amount of its capital fund on the city of Sydney, not only where everyone lives, but without planning and without doing something, the conditions of life for people who live in parts of Sydney are simply miserable. And that's what happens. Another example, perhaps more optimistic, is that of Adelaide. Colonel Light, of great memory, provided the city with an admirable plan. That's North Adelaide at the top and the city below, separated by the Torrens River. And because the city initially grew slowly, Adelaide started with a bang, or the settlement started with a bang, but it took until the 1860s, and the need for food from the goldfields of New South Wales and Victoria for South Australia suddenly to become prosperous. The parklands that Colonel Light surrounded the city with remained. Actually, they weren't parklands at all. The early settlers cut down every single tree, so there was nothing there at all. What you see today is very much human development. In the 20th century, there seemed no thought of continuing the building according to some adaptation of Colonel Light's plan, and it simply grew outwards along the main arterial road. So today it looks like that, and the little bit in the centre is Colonel Light's Adelaide. It's nearly 100 kilometres from the top north-east, or the right-hand side, to the bottom left. 20 kilometres deep, wide, or 30 kilometres widest at its widest. And if you go into those areas, you can see that the grid plan moved along the arterial road, so that as each new quasi-settlement developed, it was at right angles to the road, wherever the road was. And that's very, very, very common in Australia. Excuse me. Suburbs developed, railways were introduced, water supply was done, but no planning occurred outside a suburban context. The Elizabeth area, developed after the Second World War, is distinctively different because of its neighbourhoods, very like ours in the Woden Valley, built around small shopping centres, and of the general absence in Elizabeth of the grid. Streets are curved, not orthogonal. Of course, there's now a plan for the whole of the city of Adelaide, but in that concept, the planned city of 1839 has become the CBD. And Greater Adelaide now has this huge footprint. Now, the story of Adelaide provides powerful lessons about planning cities. The three great ingredients, in my view, for a successful venture are vision, plan and will. The vision comes first, and it has to come first, because a great deal of energy and money will be expended in developing the new city project. The vision has to capture the imagination and to provide attractive possibilities for those who are to live in the result. The plan sets out the basic geometry of the city, its public places, how people are to get from one place to another, where they'll buy food, and at least in past times, its defences. Will is the underlying support base of both the vision and the plan, and it has to be there from the beginning, because from the very start of every plan there are objectors, who will include those who didn't get the job of drawing up the plan, those who see some other use for the land, those who don't want to go there anyway, and people familiar to us all who just like to object. I've mentioned Colonel Light's Adelaide, and you need to know that he had in mind, if I go back, each of those little things you see is a block of 1 acre. So Colonel Light's vision of Adelaide is not what you see today. he saw everyone having an acre where they could have a house and they could stable their horse, they could have a cow, they could have chooks and so forth. It didn't happen like that. And no matter how long Colonel Light had lived, he would not have been able to produce that outcome. It was sensible at the beginning. It ceased to be sensible later on. But his basic shape for the city has survived. And it's I think, Adelaide, apart from this city, or of the state capitals, Adelaide is far and away the most attractive, and you have a good sense of a good city when you're there, especially when you get to the centre. Vision and plan can only be guessed for the older cities, London, Paris and Madrid, for example. Paris is very old, about 6,000 years, older than Mohenjo-Daro. There have been people living there for 6,000 years. And hang on, what have I done here? I've got pages out of order. The shape of Paris has been dictated by the changing shape of the River Seine. I used to live in Paris at once in the 1960s, and I bought a Turgot Paris tax map of the city, 1739, which showed what a huge proportion of the land had been given over to storing firewood for winter. But it also showed an island called Louviers, which I lived on, Ile Saint-Louis, just behind Notre Dame. And there was another island in the 18th century behind ours. It's gone. They filled that in. And the river is now, of course, almost a stormwater channel. In fact, most rivers in settled countries are now stormwater channels. They're dammed, controlled and corralled. It doesn't always work because, as we've seen in America recently, when you get very heavy rain, and melting snow and all the rest of it, even the Missouri and Mississippi system, which is levee banked almost without exception, that's not enough if there's too much rain. And partly Paris has been shaped by the edicts of France's rulers, and the great boulevards we admire today, like that one, which is familiar, I'm sure, to you all, is the result not it's not part of old Paris. 1860, it's Haussmann, who was instructed by Napoleon, the second or third Napoleon, to make sure that those bloody peasants inside the city couldn't build barricades anymore. If you've seen Les Miserables, you will have seen the barricade, a beautiful piece of stage set that was. But that's what they did. They put carts and anything they could and block off the streets. Why? Because Paris was a maze of little streets and alleyways, and Haussmann got rid of most of them so that there was nowhere where you could block off the city. You couldn't do the commune again. Okay. When Haussmann did that, he displaced 500,000 people. 500,000 lost their houses, and their sense of neighbourhood, that went. Presumably the owners of the land were compensated, but the renters, because they had to find somewhere else. When things are half done, once that's done, it's really undoable. You can't go back to where it was before. But when things are half done, you can. And this is what happened in St. Petersburg, another planned city. Peter the Great wanted to get out of Moscow. He didn't like Moscow. Nobody liked Moscow. They still don't like it. And he wanted a city by the sea because he was oriented to the west and he wanted a good port and he wanted to feel part of Europe. He first built a fortress at the site. I'll show it to you. At the right-hand bottom comes the river, and out here on the left-hand side is the Gulf of Finland. And there's a maze of canals and river flowings there. And the idea was to put the city in the very centre, which it is, and it's on the canal itself, and everything else is built around it. A huge amount of work. And 9 years later, when the place was overrun with people wanting to get part of the action, long before he wanted anyone there at all, he moved the capital from Moscow to St. Petersburg. And he hired an Italian planner who designed it all for him. And he said, "This is it." And he was a bit like that. And he died in 1725. So basically he had 22 years from the time he first built the fortress until he died. And almost instantly they moved the capital back to Moscow. Then they decided he was right after all, so they moved it back to St. Petersburg and they finished the work that Peter the Great had done. Then when the Bolshevik Revolution occurred in 1917, they moved the capital back to Moscow because they were too close to the Germans. So that's the capital that's moved backwards and forwards. But while he was there, he built a number of things that you build. That's the University of St. Petersburg. And he built a high school for very proficient students. If you think that's the Soviet system, no. That was Peter the Great started that. He also founded the Russian Academy of the Sciences and so forth. He thought of it as a capital, and the capital would have to have these things, and so he ordained that they be there. But he was not a popular person, and the rate of change that he put into Russia caused a huge reaction. So you can have, if your will is too strong, you create a counter pressure. And I'll come to that at the very end. Will and plan are important in another way, because while the plan almost immediately attracts opposition, it also is a magnet for people who see, hey, there's a bit of action here, let's get some of it. And this happened when Brasilia was built. Now that's Brasilia from the air. And it is big, B-I-G. It's much bigger than, and its whole scale is much, much bigger than us. Here's a vista. That's not a vista you walk from one end to the other of. And if you look in the background, those of you close up will be able to see the water system is gigantic. I mean, this place is on a monumental scale, far outstripping Washington or Canberra. And what happened, within 4 years of Niemeyer setting it up, it was a shanty town. It attracted everybody who thought that there might be some money for them in it. It took 30 years to get rid of the shanty towns. The initial building of it was incredible. 4 years from start to finish. They built all the main buildings and the infrastructure of the roads in 4 years. Now we're firmly in the domain of national capitals, and I'm going to make a couple of comments about two others before I move to Canberra. Ottawa and Washington, and Brasilia and Canberra are all federal capitals, and in each case they represent the nation. And in each case they are an example of the conjunction of vision, plan and will. Each has had its difficulties. The name of each has become shorthand in a pejorative way for the national government or the federal government. Each was placed where it was for a reason. You probably all know this, but you're a captive audience, so you'll hear it again. Washington is on the Mason-Dixon line. It's on the border of the North and the South. Ottawa is on the border of English-speaking and French-speaking Canada. Literally, I mean, across the river in Ottawa is Quebec. It's in Ontario. Brasilia is placed in the geographic centre of Brazil, and Canberra, as you all know, was ordained to be somewhere in New South Wales, but not closer than 100 miles to Sydney. Now, Ottawa is the odd one out here because it doesn't have a plan, or didn't have it was a logging town, a timber town. And in fact, when I first went to Ottawa, there was a paper mill down below Parliament on the river using the force of the river to generate power. It's now a museum, but when did I first go there? Again, the late 60s or early, late 60s. It was a logging town and Parliament was plonked on it, and it never really got a plan. It didn't get a plan until the 1950s. And fortunately, there was a good deal of civic pride. The Canadians are very responsible people. I like Canadians. And those who lived in Ottawa said, you know, we've got to make this better than it is, because there's no power, there's no plan, there's no vision, there's no will, but we're here. So they made Ottawa a very attractive town. And then it got a plan, and the plan is it's got one good thing in it, which I'm trying to persuade our government to have, and that is a 50-year forward look, revised every 10 years. So you move forward 50 years and you have Parliament speak on it every 10. This is Washington. This is L'Enfant, 1791, French architect with his plan. And you can see the grid is very powerful, but he's done something which was very, very useful and is increasingly useful. He put diagonals in so you could get quickly from one part of the city to another. If you remember Mohenjo-Daro, it's very, very grid-shaped, very orthogonal. So to get anywhere, you've got to get from one side to another, you've got to create your own diagonal, which is very time-consuming. L'Enfant put them in. I just want to say one. I want to go on back to Ottawa. There's Ottawa, and just out of sight, where you can see the tip of the river, the tip of the little island on which the industrial plant was. The Parliament is more or less in the centre. There's a white thing there. That's the Parliamentary Library. Beautiful sight. Absolutely beautiful sight. It's a great place to put. They just didn't plan it as well. They just said, oh, we'll put it there. Another thing, it was out of sight of the Americans. Now, the Americans were the enemy. The last fight that had occurred on North America is 1812 between the British and the Americans. The Canadians had suffered, so they wanted a capital city which was not within range of the Americans, and it isn't. And it's about equidistant from Toronto and Montreal, the two large cities. Nice, it's in a very nice city. Now, come to ours, which is in many respects the greatest triumph of the conjunction of vision, plan and will, though somewhat paradoxically through indifference rather than anything else. It's the longest surviving planned city of the modern era that has kept its plan and its character, though it's nearly 100 years old. And you all know the design and building story, and I'll only focus on a couple of aspects of it. One is the sculptural quality of the city in its setting. Walter Burley Griffin recognised the power of that setting, especially when he got here, but he recognised it even from the illustrations and the plan. And he said, you have to adapt the city to the environment. Don't do Chicago, don't do New York, don't make big skyscrapers. Blend in with it. And successive generations have accepted that initial perspective, which explains why today's Canberra, though very much larger than Griffin's original conception, there's Griffin, and the big piece of water in the right-hand side is a bit of lake we never built. That's now the wetlands, which many people think are natural, which is another paradox, but Canberra's full of them. And there we are. There's 406,000 people in Canberra and Queanbeyan. Griffin designed for 25,000. And I will pay my tribute now to the Salmons and the Holfords, who said, this city is going to grow and grow and grow, and the motor car is the way it's going to grow, but we'll try and keep the spirit of it, the essence of it. I know there are people who don't like platonic essences, but that's what they thought they were doing, and I think on the whole they did it rather well. The city has what architect and historian James Birrell has called a soft, gentle touch. I liked that when I heard him say it, and I'm repeating it. I hope you all repeat it too. This is a very unusual city in that way, and it takes people a long time from outside to understand it. But once they live here for 18 months or so, they adopt its special character with great enthusiasm. Now, the second aspect of Canberra, which is really, really important, is that the original ownership of the national capital is its present ownership. It's all owned, every square metre, by the people of Australia through the Commonwealth Parliament or the Commonwealth Government. And as we've seen, most new towns start with a plan and an authority that insists that the plan be followed, but it is often not long before the plan or the authority or both lose their force. Other things get in the way. As I told you in the Sydney case, rapid growth and just continued rapid growth made nonsense of any attempt to restrict where you could build houses because there was such demand for it. And we're a democratic society where people get elected every 3 years. And if you don't provide what your constituents want quickly, you're unlikely to be there after the next election. And one of the things that affected Canberra and affected everything in Australia was this conjunction of depressions and war. From 1890 to 1950, 60 years, virtually nothing much happened because we had two great depressions and two great wars, and the attention of the government and the attention of our people went on other matters. And it wasn't really until the Menzies government of the middle 50s where the decision was finally made to do something and finish the national capital. I've used that phrase and I'll come back to it at the end. Visions, plan and will were put aside. In Canberra, development stopped in 1914, resumed in the early 20s, stopped in 30, resumed during the Second World War when the plan was pushed aside to allow the construction of scores of temporary buildings, and resumed properly in the mid-1950s with a new plan based very much on Griffin's in 1911, modified by new understandings of how people lived and worked and moved after the Second World War. And in my view, the slow development of the national capital in its first 50 years at least saved it from the curse of rapid development and allowed the plan to bed down. I first came here in 1943 and we lived in Currong Street, Reed, and to get to what we called Civic Centre, which was the Melbourne and Sydney buildings, I went on my bicycle over builders' dumps diagonally across blocks which are now occupied by houses. And one day I said to my mum, "Mum, what's all that for?" Because what had happened was that the streets had been put in and then the Depression came. They weren't tarred, there were no footpaths, no curbs, but you could see there was an intention. And she had a great phrase. She said, "Darling, that's for later on." And later on is one of my great beliefs in the city, that we have always to think of later on. John Grant, my colleague from the UC, is here, and he will recall a discussion we had at the University of Canberra about whether or not to fill in the one vacant space in the concourse, which is a beautiful design based on Harvard Yard. And there was one hole left. And I said, "I'm not going to do it. That's for later on." And it's still there. Nobody's built on it. And that's great. One day, there'll be a really good reason to build on it. There are eight building blocks in front of you when you go out of Parliament. The eight possible buildings can be built in the parliamentary zone. And I don't want to see any of them in my time. I think you have to... We've got to think in terms of a very long period of time in which there will be the right place on the right spot at the right time. And another important aspect of this is that the Commonwealth has been the permission granter. So for 100 years, to do anything, you required permission. Now, we're a hugely authoritarian culture, Australia. Probably the most authoritarian culture outside a dictatorship. And that's because we accept authority as well as impose it. And the notion that you have to ask permission is very much part of our culture. Peter Carmel told me it's the wrong attitude. You should do things first and then apologise afterwards. And the permissions that have been given have been largely in harmony with the plan. Opinions will differ, but mine is that Walter Griffin magically restored to us and asked to give his views on the Canberra of 2011, he would be generally impressed. Of course, he would need a week or two to get used to other aspects of contemporary life, like air travel, the computer, Eddie Maguire and the motor vehicle, and none of that might impress him greatly, so I'd wait for a week and ask him then. But I think he'd say, "You haven't done a bad job." In 1988 came the first real change in the development of the national capital, and Canberra had grown large enough to warrant a qualified form of self-government. One outcome was the creation of the National Capital Plan and the Associated Territory Plan. The two plans divide responsibility for the development of the national capital, with the Commonwealth's retaining control of the national capital element and the ACT government given responsibility for what might be called the suburban and municipal elements. This division has worked well, though from time to time there are disagreements and overlap. But because the territory plan is subordinate to the national capital plan, the Commonwealth's view tends to win through if and when there are arguments. This division is, in my view, permanent. We're not going to go back to the Department of the Interior, and those of you who want to shed a tear should do so now. We have to make the division work and work well over the next 100 years. That's about as far as I can see ahead. And the second thing that is permanent is the Commonwealth's reluctance to spend more money on the city, on the national capital. And what has happened is that the granting of self-government to the ACT has created a kind of blinkered view, in my words, that, well, it's done. The national capital is finished. It's done. Parliament's here. There's nothing temporary anymore. It's all permanent. And the ACT government's got self-government, so they can run it. Now, that's not a silly view, but I don't think it's a very good view. This place, our city, is going to have 500,000 inhabitants before very long, and it will pass 1 million before the end of the century, and it'll be 1.5 million about 100 years from now, if the population of the national capital grows only at the rate of growth of the country itself. And sometimes it's more and sometimes it's less, but on average, Canberra grows as Australia grows. Now, you'll encounter the view that the national capital as a place is simply a necessary evil. It was the price of federation. And it ought to be ignored. I mean, it's there, does its job, get on with it. But it overlooks two important points, each directly connected to vision, plan and will. The first is that Griffin's vision was not simply of a national capital of great buildings of representation and government, law and collections, as you could have said for Washington or for St. Petersburg, but a human settlement in a landscape in which people would live good lives and enjoyable lives and productive lives. And aspects of Griffin's ideal have spread all over Australia, where some two-thirds of the housing stock of our country has been built since 1960. And a lot of it, if you fly over it, you can see Canberra in the way in which the new suburbs have been laid out. The avoidance of the grid, a focus on people-friendly roads and layouts, neighbourhood schools and shopping centres and so on. I should make clear, Griffin didn't invent this. This is Garden City stuff from the 19th century. But in Australia, he popularised it. And everyone has copied it, because the federal system gives you 8 jurisdictions in which to look at different ways of doing things. That's one of the great virtues of federations, which you don't often hear about. I'll give another lecture on that one day. With respect to the national capital, that means, in my view, that Griffin's vision is still with us, and the Commonwealth has entered onto an experiment, 100 years old now, to build a city that shows what human thought, creativity and planning can do in providing an environment for human beings that is beautiful, effective and efficient, and in which creativity flourishes. It follows that the Commonwealth would not want to see parts of its national capital descend into this kind of squalor. That's Washington in the 1940s. The bottom picture, if you're close enough, you can just see the Capitol at the end of that street. I know Washington well too, and I've been in parts of it which are just awful. I love Washington, so I get a great buzz whenever I go there. But we don't have to have everything in Australia which looks like something else. This city is very special. I want to keep it that way. I like capital cities wherever they are, and especially ours. There you go. That's the Hollywood picture of Canberra. But that's what I show people as chairman of the NCA when they come here. We get about 100 delegations or experts coming to look at the national capital every year from overseas, and you take them to the top of Mount Ainslie. I have to say I've never had quite such a good day as that one. But they look at it and they say, wow, wow. And one of them, I'm trying to remember where he was from, but it was either Belarus or Slovakia or anyway, somewhere there. He said, and you people have done all this in only 100 years? Because in Europe they think in terms of thousands of years. I mean, every city can go back 2, 3, 4 thousand years. We can't. That's 100 years worth. But I worry, and this is the end, this is the take-home message, I worry all the time that indifference and inattention can lead to the development of very poor living conditions in our own national capital without anyone ever intending it. It's the cost of the death of the thousand cuts. No one ever intended the outcome. You just keep doing it. It's like efficiency dividends for the National Gallery or another of my responsibilities, the Cultural Facilities Corporation. These places are for people to come and enjoy and see something larger and more important than they themselves as individuals. The only efficiency that you can gain is to reduce the opportunities for them to do that, and yet that's what they're for. So I think it's important that the Commonwealth continue to have an overriding interest, not just in what you can see from Parliament House, but also in the quality of living in the capital. I can feel the slow slide towards assumptions that, for example, only the lake and the parliamentary vista are really important. The rest is simply local and should be planned and managed locally. This sort of argument occurs everywhere in any planned city. Once people are happy with what they've got out of it, they say, no, we don't need any more. That's fine now. Let's leave it as it is. The ACT government is not funded to care for the national capital and couldn't do it easily, even if it were funded. The two spheres of government properly have different interests and different priorities. What is done in the national capital has to be of high quality, and all of Canberra has to look the part. If you drive here or come by train or by air, there should be a feeling of arrival. This is your national capital. If I meet people from out of town socially, it's one of my little phrases, welcome to your national capital, and they often rear back a little, and then I point out to them that this belongs to everybody. All Australians own the national capital, so enjoy it and feel proud of it. It's good. I have to remind, if you forgive me, people like yourselves that actually the national capital doesn't belong to us who live here, it's everybody's. And they need to feel proud of its quality whenever they come because it represents themselves and their nation. It is the embodiment of the shared history, ideals and spirit of the Commonwealth of Australia. It seems to me for the next 100 years we'll need a renewal of the vision, a renewed plan and continuing will. There are endemic problems, parochialism and jealousies are ever present in federations, and those sentiments give rise to a feeling those people in Canberra shouldn't have anything that my people don't have. I had somebody of authority tell me that it was absolutely improper that Canberra people could have those electric barbecues around the lake when his constituents didn't have them in his town. And I thought, you know, how much do I want this job? And but then pointed out as well as I could that actually it was the ratepayers of Canberra who paid for the electric barbecues, not the Commonwealth, and that his city council could put in electric barbecues as it wished. But I didn't quite say it like that. The national capital isn't finished, and in my view, it'll never be finished. It is a kind of process. As the country changes, the national capital will change. The way it looks, I hope, the way it feels will remain as beautiful in the future as it is now. But we'll need a proper partnership between the Commonwealth and the ACT government, a partnership built on shared values and on a recognition that Australia's national capital is an outstanding success in world terms, and it should be no less so in a century's time than it is now. I know that senators are very busy people, and not least when they're in the national capital. But if any senators present would like to learn more about one of their primary responsibilities as legislators, my colleagues and I will be only pleased to show them whatever they would like to see whenever they would like to see it. Indeed, I will personally take any senator who would like to do so to the two most stunning vantage points in the national capital, Mount Ainslie and Mount Pleasant, where you can see at once what Griffin was driving at, and I can return them to Parliament House in lunchtime. Thank you.
Well, we do have a little time for questions. If anyone would like to ask a question, please come to the microphone. There are two downstairs and one upstairs. And sir, you've beaten everyone else again, so you have the floor.
First of all, congratulations on bringing history back to Australia. You started with it. We haven't even caught up with ancient history, let alone our own. So thank you for your history. The second one is, when are we going to have your next lecture? Put that aside for a moment. But you used two words. We are an authoritarian country.
Culture.
How did we allow that to happen? The point is, I only had one word that I had to hang on to. I thought of an alternative. And what I want to see is that wonderful painting up there. I want that taken down. And I want to see a map of Australia and its underdevelopment stressed. Thank you for this. This is the one that I've watched where somebody had the sense to say, we're visual. A wonderful thing, but tell me, do you really think that our federation really is real?
I just make a quick correction. I said an authoritarian culture. And we started as a prison. I'm a road safety person as well. I go into Victoria. Victorians are very polite. They say, please help us to save lives. In New South Wales, they say, do it or we'll thump you. And the notion that you can have power in Australia, and when you've got power, you can exercise it because you've got it, is right through us, I think, as a society. And we also, as the recipients of authority from above, accept that, yep, you can do it, but if we don't like it, we'll thump you and we'll toss you out at the next election. That's the authoritarian culture I was talking about.
Hi, John Holland's my name. I just have a query based on the what's been happening in recent times. A lot of conflict going on in Canberra about the development. I'm talking here mainly more in the outside the national capital area, although there's been something going on there too. Now, there's a lot of people at Loggerheads. The latest one's been at Jamison Centre. You know, that anything ACPLA seems to come up with, it gets involved in fights with either the residence groups or the developers or politicians. You know, at the moment, you know, I've looked at what ACPLA is supposed to supervise, as well as the territory plan. It's got to take into account, you know, the spatial plan and also the neighbourhood plan, precinct plans, all this sort of thing. To my way, I think it's shambolic. And I think that I heard Elder Jurgler sort of describe the planning in Canberra as being not planning anymore, but just ad hoc. Yeah. And this is the way we are. We're heading towards our 100th anniversary. Do you think it's time that maybe these various plans around were somehow brought together, some, you know, and reconciled? We come up with something like you were talking about earlier, a plan, I've forgotten which country it was, but a plan for the next 50 years to be revised every 10 years. Do you think it's time now, as we head towards our centenary, that it is time to stop all this conflict and to try and make that sort of thing of the past and to pull together a sort of a revised plan? I wouldn't suggest another competition for another Walter Burley Griffin, but for the disparate groups that are around could come to some sort of agreement on where Canberra should go for the next 20 to 50 years. Do you think it's time for that?
Yes, indeed I do. And I've been saying it from my position as chairman of the National Capital Authority since I got that post 3 years ago. I don't think you're going to get rid of conflict. Conflict is endemic in our society, because, especially now, because we, as I wrote a chapter in a book a few years ago, which was called From We to Me, and that was the last 50 years after we'd come out of two wars and two depressions. There was a very strong, what I would call solidary or community feeling that we, us, are very important. It had some downsides. I mean, your parents would say, don't draw attention to yourself, dear. You know, keep your head down, because otherwise you'll get thumped. But and then over the next 50 years, we've got three times wealthier, there were three times larger a country. All the emphasis now is on me. And me says, I don't like what you're doing, don't do it. But we just get enormous amount of noise that way. But for the national capital, I think it's hugely important that we recognise that, that there's a kind of general recognition that it hasn't stopped growing and it won't stop growing. I know there are people who wish it would, but I see no way in which it could stop growing. And that its future is as much a responsibility of us, we who live here, and of those who are for whom we are the custodians of their national capital. That's to say, we should have a lot of discussion about this. Now, those population figures I used, they're estimates. They're not real. I can't prove you that they're going to happen. But to give you an example, we are not going to have light rail or trams or anything like that until we are quite considerably bigger than we currently are, because it's going to cost a vast amount of money to put the infrastructure in. But once you see that the city is going to be 1 million, say, by 2070 or whatever, then governments will say, it's time we did it. Now, we have the capacity to do it here because we control the land. The land allocation is partly mine, partly the NCA's, and it's partly ACPLA. It's partly the ACT government. We could do that tomorrow. That wouldn't be difficult. It wouldn't be right because you haven't been involved in it. I mean, this is a very well-educated democracy. 30% of the workforce of this city has a university degree. 10% of the people in this city are university or post-secondary students. And we don't use the best of that in looking forward. Why don't we? Because our governments are always worried about the next election. They mightn't be here. Governments tend to drop decisions on you on Friday afternoon to take place on Monday morning. It's not the way I would do it at all. I would say to you now, we need to think in terms of what this city will look like when it's got 1 million people in it. That's visually possible for me. I can see it. The footprint's not going to be much different unless we move the borders north towards Murrumbateman. Do you want to do that? I mean, does New South Wales want us to do that? Is the Commonwealth interested in doing it? We've got to talk about these things. They're very important things to talk about, because if we don't move the borders, we're going to go that way. Now, that's not a bad thing in principle. A lot of people don't want to live on four houses to the acre. And Bev and I were in Leipzig last year or the year before, and Leipzig is very much about the same size as Canberra, but very much smaller. But it has a vast amount of green space. Why? Well, because they all live in apartments. There's only two suburbs which have houses in them. Everyone else is in apartments. There are wonderful parks which are you can access easily from where you are, and a very good light rail system. You know, so to say we can't do it is giving up. The important question is that our governments need to say to us, the citizens of the city and the citizens of the country, the national capital will continue to grow and it's got to be as good in 100 years as it is now. Let's help, let's be Victorians and not say thumpier. Let's work together to produce a really good outcome.
Now we've got three questioners lined up downstairs, so we'll do the three downstairs first and then we'll go to you in the gallery.
Thank you, Rosemary. Professor, thank you so much for presenting Canberra in this way. For my sins, and I'm not speaking on behalf of the War Memorial where I have some association, but nonetheless, as a presenter there, I pretty much show visitors from overseas in particular that vista, which is unmatched in my view. But I see in recent correspondence with the Canberra Times and indeed articles that the National Capital Authority has taken a right bollocking for its involvement in the what's been described in this morning's Canberra Times on page 18 as the monstrosities of the war memorials at the end of the Ron Terraces. To my mind, the National Capital Authority got it very, very wrong indeed. Would you like to rebut or confirm?
I've had to say this at the Joint Standing Committee. What my views are, and those of my colleagues on the authority, is irrelevant. The process that was used that resulted in those models, in my view, was a valid process. Full stop. If we were doing it today, we would go down a different path, because in the last 3 years we've changed a great deal of the way the NCA operates, particularly in its engagement with the community. We've also proposed that the National Memorials Committee be constructed in a different way, be serviced by us. We should be the secretariat for it, and we've gained that, so we are now the secretariat for the National Memorials Committee. But what occurred in the past, none of us who are presently on the authority were there, was valid. If we were doing it again today, I wouldn't do it that way. That's the best answer I can give you.
Sir David.
Professor Aitken, back in the mid-1960s, the then Department of the Interior of happy memory, and yes, I've shed my tear, was preparing against the day when a future government might decide that the ACT should have self-government. And a report prepared then suggested that whatever form of self-government the ACT was ultimately to receive, that it would be desirable if all planning remained with the federal government through whatever statutory authority was proposed. Would you comment, should we go back? Perhaps we can't. Would it have been better if that report, that particular recommendation, had been adopted? Or do you really believe we can make our bifurcated planning system work better than it works today?
David, it actually doesn't work too badly today. And one reason is that the people in ACPLA share the same aesthetic and historic values that the people in NCA have. When you get a problem, it's something like the Gungahlin Drive extension. That's again is before my time. In fact, I was at UC when that was occurring, and where you get two governments with a different sense of the right outcome. And in that case, the Commonwealth will always win, because the Commonwealth's plan is superior to the Territory's plan. In practice, our staff at the NCA work very well with the ACPLA staff. There's very little disagreement. The problems that we face are the obvious ones. The Territory is poorly funded. It's very much today like the colonies were in the 19th century after the gold rushes. The colonies had two forms of making money to provide services. One was to sell land, and the other was to impose customs duties. Well, Katie Gallagher's government can't impose customs duties, so all they got really is our rates and selling land. So for them, any time they can make a quid, a buck, a dollar, some money out of selling some land, that enables them to build another baby health centre or whatever. That's the way they see it, and they are operating in a very small vista of time. For whatever reason, I operate in very long vistas of time. I do see and think 20, 30, 40, 50 years ahead, and I do think that we can have a bifurcated planning system that does work well. The present one doesn't work badly. I think it can work much better, especially if we get the community to understand that that's what we're doing. So much of what is done now is knee-jerk reaction, because you don't hear about it early enough to know, to be able to set it in context. As I say, if you think of that, we've got the present footprint of the city. There's a bit more that could be developed at Cowan. There's a bit more on the way out on the left-hand side of the Barton Highway. But really, that's trivial, maybe 5 to 10% extra footprint. There's a million people here. There'll be three people living where there's one now. That's what it means. How can we do that well? That's the problem.
Sir.
Professor Aitken, Don... thank you very much for your presentation today. I'm David Flannery from the University of Canberra. I think I'd like to invite you back at the end of this year to come and talk to some of my architecture students on this very topic. But you did make some comments in your wrap-up about Canberra as the national capital, and you told us about some of your interstate, international guests that express a bit of shock when you, or the Australians, that they say when you say welcome to our national capital. This is an area that interests me a real lot because I think Canberra bashing is still alive and well in the interstate capitals. I'm off in a couple of weeks' time myself to have a look at Washington and Ottawa for the first time, and I'm very keen when I'm there to tap into the opinion, the regard that Americans and Canadians have for their respective capitals, because I think it's probably a little bit stronger than it is for Australians generally. What would be, however, your opinion in the way that Australians look at their capital compared to the North Americans?
Very quickly, it's very similar. There's one difference, and that is the American president is so powerful and seen within the United States to be so powerful that there is a kind of... It's part of your job as a father and mother to take your kids to Washington to see the White House and see where the president lives and the rest of it. We've got a bit of that, probably got more of it than the Canadians have. But if you go to Alberta, where I've been, and you mention that you've been in Ottawa, they call it Ottawa. And if you're in the Dakotas, you know, the Midwest of the US or the far west of the US, they say Washington. It's not a nice sound. And there's a straightforward rule. The closer you are to the source of power, the happier you feel, at least the more confident you feel about the way the power is used. The further away you are, the less knowledge you have and the less comfort you have with what is being done. Very, very simple. Do go, David, when you're in... Go and look at, talk to the people in the our equivalents in Washington and Ottawa. I think they're both called the National Capital Commission, not authority. And they're very pleasant people, and they'll be very happy to show you. So I think the Canadians like Ottawa less than Australians like Canberra, but there wouldn't be much in it. And I can't speak at all about Brasilia.
Patience. So last question goes to the lady up in the gallery. Thank you.
My experience is probably coming back to Canberra after having visited in the earlier days. I think Canberra is now a less attractive city than it was 30 years ago. If you come, that vista is very nice, but I notice it doesn't show us the traffic lights that have now been placed on Anzac Avenue. The vista over to Parliament House is also very nice, but it doesn't show us all of the open space covered by cars. We don't see the roads that are chock-a-block at least twice a day, bumper to bumper with cars. I think it's an excellent idea that Canberra needs to have money from the Australian taxpayer, but that money needs to be wisely spent, and it needs to be spent with a view to the capital itself. It shouldn't be spent millions of dollars of taxpayers' money from Ballarat and from Walgett and from Cunnamulla and from the Kimberley regions, millions of dollars of their money to spend on a four-lane road, to spend on an underpass to allow access to the airport to be quicker. These are personal internal items which should be dealt with by the local government. They're not built for the nation as a whole. I think we need to seriously look at the future of Canberra. We need to say, what are we here for? It's only a service centre. It doesn't produce anything. It doesn't actually physically do a lot. It does a lot of talking, but it actually doesn't do anything. Do we need to have a million people here in the future doing the same thing, providing service industries for a whole lot of other people who are providing service industries for others? We need a really, really radical rethink. We need access for people who come to Canberra. We need far better transport options, light rail and the rest. Otherwise, Canberra in the future will be a slow-moving car park full of CO2 emissions. The green space will be continually turned into car parks. So I think that it's nice to say it's a lovely city. It's a less lovely city than it was, and maybe we need to make it a more lovely city again. Thank you.
It's precisely to hear that kind of perspective and to hear it argued out and responded to, if there are people who want to respond, that I would like to see the future of Canberra debated constantly. I mean, it's just part of our living that we should debate these issues and these questions. I don't have a particular response to what you've said. I think I could say, yeah, I think I'd probably agree with you a bit. The cars are choking the city. Of course, nothing comparable to Sydney. But it was lovely to hear good old mercantilism being used as it's a long time since I taught political science, but I used to have a lecture on mercantilism, and you've given a wonderful example of it. That the whole population of Australia rests at the moment on the 3% of the population who produce agriculture and pastoral products and the 1% of the population who produce mining products. The rest of us are all paper pushers, really. And I don't think Canberra's any more or less that than Sydney or Melbourne or anywhere else is. It's not the country it was 100 years ago. And thank you all for listening. It's been most enjoyable. Thank you.
Yes, we have gone a little over time, but it's been a fabulous topic today. So thank you for coming, and please join me in thanking Professor Aitken for such inspiring reflections on the city we love.
Thank you.